I have to confess, I invited you here under false pretenses. This is not a meeting about freedom of speech or a political prisoner. This is big people's talent time. So if anybody wants to do some dancing or whatever, you're up next. But I think I guess we should start the real meeting. I want to thank very much all of you for coming down. I know some of you have come from quite a distance. And
I'm okay.
I'm sitting on there. And our guest tonight probably needs no introduction, except that she's a person who spent the last 35 years of her life in Jasper, was very well known, a community spirit, always prepared to volunteer for services if there was a benefit or whatever. She played in many bands and groups and so on. Was a well-known entertainer and teaches violin, and very well liked in the community until. And when you hear the story, I think it makes you a little bit critical of Canadians and their attitudes. I think Canadians like to think of themselves, we're the nice people. We're nice. Americans are brash, and French are arrogant, and Chinese, well. But we're not, we're nice people. Well, when you hear the story of Jasper, remember, many of these people were her friends or close acquaintances. She was well-liked, she was well-known. I've always thought it's easier to despise or hate someone you don't know. You read something in the paper and say, oh, I hate that guy. I hate mass murderer Paul Bernardo. It's easier to hate if you don't know. But people knew her. And the way they turned on her was like something out of a bad 1920s novel about a narrow-minded small town. Anyway, without any further ado, I want you to give her a good capital British Columbia welcome to BC.
Thank you so much for coming, everybody. And yeah, I think half of you were here before we were tonight, so that was cutting it close. But oh, I'm so glad to be here. It's just wonderful. What a warm welcome. Yeah, what Paul was talking about, there's a term for that, ritual defamation. That's something I became an expert on. I'd never really heard of that before, although I knew there were whistleblowers who had a hard time and this and that, people who step out of line of what we're allowed to think and say, but that's a whole other topic. Today I didn't really want to spend too much time talking about the ritual defamation chapter of my life. That was the year and a half from June 2016 when this little video, Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust, appeared, went out into the world. And then in December of 2017, so that was a year and a half later, excuse me. clear my throat here. So that's when I decided to go to Germany for just over Christmas and New Year's, like for a month, for a holiday to visit my brother who lives over there. And we were having a grand time, with, you can imagine, great dinner time conversations. And we even jumped into the lake on January 1st, like a little polar dip. So glad I did that. I kind of kept that feeding my spirit as I was then incarcerated in this little tiny cell for 10 months. Kept thinking about that swim in the lake, not really a swim, dip on January 1st to bring in the new year. Well, I'm still got, I don't know how that happened, just a minute here.
You're just a Canadian citizen?
I am a Canadian citizen. My brother is also a Canadian citizen.
Any German
but
citizen?
he is also a German citizen. I was born after my parents had been Canadian citizens for five. Well, after they became Canadian citizens, they immigrated from Germany in the 50s, and the children who were born within 5 years of that, so before they actually get their citizenship, they are eligible to get dual citizenship. Okay. But I came along later. So I don't have German citizenship, but Alfred does. So, but he's got Canadian, he's still Canadian as well. Anyway, January 3rd, Sylvia Stolz, that name probably means something to all of you, I would think. She was in prison for several years. She was the attorney, one of Ernst Sunde's lawyers, and had done her job a little too well. That was back then, yes, indeed. And this relates very much to what happened to Alfred and I in our trial, in terms of what you are allowed to say in court when you are a political prisoner. It boggles the mind. So, January 3rd, Sylvia Stolz was once again facing the Inquisition. She was in court, one of many court days, concerning a speech she had given in Switzerland, and it was at a conference that I think it was all about freedom of speech, and she had actually not mentioned the word Holocaust once in her speech, but in the context, this is how they put it, she was charged in Germany under this paragraph 130. And we wanted to attend court because this was very interesting for us, and I had never met her before. She was a hero of mine, and I thought, let's go, of course. I wouldn't want to miss out on that. So we drove into Munich and got to the courthouse, and we're early, and I'm saying to Alfred, oh, this seems so strange. It felt very strange. And yes, this is the Inquisition. There was some greasy, long-haired guy in a cloak that was kind of swooping around, doing this and that, pushing paper this way and that way, and he was a clerk, and then when the judge came in, I believe there were two judges, and then prosecutor, and at one point, okay, proceedings started, Sylvia Stolz was there and waved from a distance. I'd never actually met her, like I say, but we had a smile and a wave from a distance, and her lawyer beside her. But on the prosecutor side, like, this started, and I think they fell asleep. Like, it was incredible. I thought, this is out of Charles Dickens or something. It really felt strange. And then very suddenly, like 40 minutes into this court case, suddenly they do a recess, and it was a surprise. Everybody was surprised. But okay, they're doing a recess. So we all wander out into the corridor, those of us who were in the public gallery and talking and in a circle, having a great time meeting these very interesting and wonderful people. And suddenly a woman with sort of longish blonde hair comes swooping over to me and addresses me, and what's your name, and step over here a little bit, and this and that. And then these three armed thugs, I would call them, but they're policemen. They're armed to the hilt, you know, the vest and everything. And she says, that's her! That's her, that's Monica Schaefer, arrest her. Like, she was just like this, I don't know what you would call it. It was, again, out of a movie or, you know, from long ago or something. I just protested. I said, hey, I'm a Canadian citizen, I'm a free person. What authority do you have? Like, you know, what are you doing? No, I'm free, I'm a free person, I'm a Canadian citizen. And then one of them said, you should have thought of that before you left Canada and came to Germany. You're not free here. This is what they said. Well, they put the handcuffs on and attached me to one of these policemen and led me off. I turned around and looking at the throng of people behind me, very solemn, standing there watching. And it's like, oh, this is the beginning of the next part of my life. And I had no idea what was before me. The next, well, I'll go a little bit fast into this part. I mean, that night I wasn't actually sent to the jail yet. I went into a police station outside of Munich, and they, you know, did some paperwork there. And I was in that cell. Actually, when I was in the office of these two police, a man and a woman who had escorted me out there, brought me out there, Fürstenfeldburg is the name of the town, I saw some interesting things on the bulletin board in their office. I don't know if they normally bring people into their office like that. I was just sitting in a chair, and they've got their computers there. They're in their desks, you know, where they're sort of right in their office. And I'm looking at the bulletin board, and there's a couple of things there that caught my attention. One of them was a little leaflet size poster that had a picture of Rudolf Hess, the one who was imprisoned for 47 years, the one who had parachuted in, I think, landed in Scotland, yep. was it? Thank you. And had tried one more effort for a peace negotiation during World War II, or was it just before World War II?
It was during World War II.
Exactly, but one more effort at peace, you know. And there was a picture of him there with, what did it say? Murder, in German, murder, under it with a circle and an X through this, like this, the hanging, that's it. They had the noose there, and suicide, no, it, the X through that, no, it was murder. And these guys had that on their wall in the police station. I thought, oh, this is interesting. Another thing they had there was, in German, skinheads are for Führer, Volk und Land. So for the leader, the folk, and the land. That's what skinheads represent. They had that on their poster, I mean on their bulletin board. I said, wow, I think these guys are tuned in, you know? But anyway, they were the police. So that night in that cell, it was this cavernous thing, very high, like twice as high as this ceiling, and a narrow cell, and it had bars down the middle of it, like, and on the other side of those bars was the sink, and on this side of the bars there was a toilet bowl and a bed, like not a bed, but a bunk with, you know, a thin mattress on it, and they gave me a couple of horse blankets and that's it. And way up there there was something that resembled, maybe it was a window and maybe there was some air coming in there. I was assured that, yes, there's fresh air coming in. And anyway, so then they left me, and there was a button there that I could push in an emergency, they said, like, if you need anything, yeah, we're here, and we'll come and help you out. Well, after they left, I noticed I was very thirsty, and that water sink is on the other side of these bars, and then I thought about using the toilet, and I thought, where's the toilet paper? And then I saw on the other side of the bars, the toilet paper was up there on the closet, and so I pushed that button, and it took them a long time, like, more than an hour, like, long time. I didn't have my watch on. They took all everything. They took that away. They took my shoelaces away in case I would hang myself with my little tiny little shoelaces. So anyway, I rang the bell and they took a long time. And I thought, well, I'm glad I'm not having an emergency. So that through the night I rang them again, and it again took 2 hours for them to get there because they didn't give me a nice tall glass of water. No, it's like this tiny little paper thing. And, you know, reach that through the bars. Like, it was bizarre, actually, that I couldn't get water. That was pretty basic. But anyway, the acoustics were really good. And I was singing. I started singing. And actually, I did that in the cell at the courthouse, too. I started to sing the Die Gedanken sind frei, Thoughts are Free. It's a song, it's an old song in German that talks about, you know, nobody can imprison your thoughts. And I made up my own verses because I didn't remember the original, all the words, and I just started singing, and it felt good. I needed to keep it together. I needed to kind of focus on something, and so I was making verses. I worked on that basically all night and slept a little bit in between. I mean, it was one way to kind of keep myself somehow focused on something other than, oh my God, this is like really bad. I'm in jail. I'm, you know, so, and I whistled too. I practicing my whistling. And the acoustics were so good, it's almost like it came out by itself. But that's how I spent my first night in jail. It wasn't yet in the official jail, but the cell of the police station. So then the next day, we'll go before a judge to see what are they going to do with me. You have to be brought before a judge within 24 hours. But I'm a flight risk, so it was very easy for them. You know, I would escape to Canada, so I'm a flight risk, and so it'd be very easy for them to justify keeping me. So then I was brought over to the jail that's the men's old prison is called Stadelheim. I just called it Stadelheim, but the women's prison, it's around the corner. It's a newer part of that prison. And, yeah, they put me into a cell with a bunch of other people there, and then the next couple of weeks I had no contact with the outside world, none whatsoever. That first period in jail really felt like an eternity. I'm sure you've all experienced time, sometimes feeling like it drags on, and other times going really, really fast. And we all have experienced that in our lives, that even though time is very precise and we have watches that tick at a very precise rate and calendars that go along very precisely, so it really, objectively, it's steady. But I've never experienced such an expansion and shrinkage of time, like in jail. This was unbelievable. In the beginning, you know, each day seemed like a long time, and then a week, like, oh, it's forever. And the first month, I would say, seemed like a whole lifetime. And then time started to speed up. And this was actually quite shocking after a while to me, how it sped up. It might seem like a good thing when you're in jail for time to go fast. However, for me, I had no idea until the hour of my release that I was, what was going to happen with me. I didn't know, especially in the beginning, the first 6 months, that there was no trial yet, no court, nothing. Charges weren't laid till April 20th. That's when I got served the actual formal charges. That's like almost 4 months into it. And time just went faster and faster. And how would I measure time, like in terms of what would happen that would make me shocked, were things like laundry or the bedding exchange. So bedding exchange would be every second Thursday. And so then suddenly it was bedding exchange. And I thought, what? I thought we just had bedding exchange just a few days ago. Oh, wasn't it just last week? No, it was 2 weeks ago. I was shocked. Like, that means, again, bedding exchange. And then it would happen again. That means that's a month that just went by. You know, it was, I didn't want to wish my life away. You know, in jail, people would be happy that time goes fast. But I didn't want to wish my life away. It was incredible, that aspect of it. How I was treated, people are, you know, ask me sometimes, how did they treat you? Well, I can tell you that in the beginning, not very well. I was the Nazi on the block. And in re-educated Germany, that's not a good thing to be. And most of these guards, they were totally in that world of being in thoroughly indoctrinated, and yeah, some of them treated me actually very, very badly as the Nazi on block. Now, other prisoners also got treated, you know, without respect, and, you know, people are humiliated and degraded and this kind of thing, but I did get a sort of an extra layer of that. However, through time, that changed, and it really changed. By the end, I felt that they were actually showing respect. Most of them were friendly. It really evolved. It was incredible, actually, how much that changed. And I think it's just because they then get to know me a little bit, and I'm a normal person. I didn't have horns growing out of my head, and that's just how it is, right? And I was cheerful most of the time. Like, most of the time, especially after the big shock of the beginning, and then I started getting into the rhythm of life in prison, and I decided very early on, I mean, I decided on day one that I was going to stay strong, and I was going to stay healthy, and I was going to keep it together. And I also knew I'm not the one who did anything wrong. That was a huge part of it. Now, if I had been guilty of some horrible crime, like, you know, maybe some violent thing where I killed somebody or whatever, then of course it would be a completely different story. But hey, I just said some things. And them jailing me, does that make me doubt that what I said was good and true? No, it does. It has the opposite effect, in fact, because, I mean, as you can all imagine, that for those of us who have woken up to what's really going on in the world, they're just proving to us that they have nothing else to use against us other than forcing us into silence by jailing us. And if they could do stronger things than that, they would. I'm grateful to be living at a time that they don't have the death penalty, because that's what they use the death penalty on, people like us who don't, you know, go along with their stories. So, yeah. So I was just saying something there about how they were treating me, and oh yeah, that I was in a good mood most of the time. And I honestly was in, I was cheerful and in a good mood most of the time in jail. I think people were kind of astonished by that, and other prisoners, they were happy about it, because I think, you know, you couldn't share that with other people, and just kind of pull people up a little bit. And not that we have tons of time together. So at first I was with people in a cell, but after about 5 weeks I got my own cell, which was better. I was happy in the beginning to be with other people, because I would have been scared actually to be in a cell by myself, because they have an awful lot of hours where you are locked into your cell and that you don't have access to anything else. There's 1 hour a day you have access to the courtyard, and then the cell doors are open for another 45 minutes while you get your hot meal midday, but then you're just in your wing. But I always ate with other people at a table in a group room there. I made a point of always eating together with people. And then they lock you in again, and then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they open the cell doors for 1.5 hours. And during that time, you'd be scrambling, you'd be busy, you'd want to maybe go for the shower, you'd want to, if you had things to do at the office, or and usually that hour and a half shrunk to maybe an hour and 10 minutes, because what happens is they open the doors and you have to stay there, you can't just go yet, because the trolley with the food, they come by, and if they're not on time, then you still have to wait there, but still, you can poke your nose out and look at your neighbors here and look at your neighbors here. And so sometimes we laughed about how, oh, all the little gophers are coming out of their holes, you know, when they'd open the door. So then the trolley would come by, and the people, the two women bringing the trolley, they were also prisoners, so some prisoners had prison jobs. And that's how it went. After they brought the food by, you'd have your time to do what you wanted to do and visit with other people. And then at 3:30, it's like Einschluss through the PA system, which means lock up, and everybody has to disappear into their little gopher holes again. And they lock the doors, and these big fat doors with three big locks. Like, those doors were so thick and so big. I mean, I just thought, my goodness, that's a bit overkill. I'd sit there at my desk. So to the left was the window with the bars looking into the courtyard, the desk, bed behind me, and then over here the door. And I look at that door and say, they just locked that door. They just, you know, those buggers, they just locked that door. I said, this is just too weird. Like, what a strange thing that they have the nerve to lock that door. And that was how I felt. But anyway, I kept myself very busy. I was working on my language skills. I got myself a couple of dictionaries, French, German, and English German, to help me with stuff. My German skills definitely improved. I mean, I speak German anyway, but the vocabulary and grammar definitely improved while I was there. I wrote a lot of letters, because I received letters. Thank you. That made my life, I'm telling you, that was just a lifeline for me. It was a lifeline for me, receiving letters. Every time I was writing a letter, I was with that person. And so that's an intense experience, because you're in jail, you're locked up, that part of it is just unreal, but you're with that person for the period of time that you're writing a letter. And so I was never alone, actually, even though I was alone, but I was never alone. Yeah, that was good. And I feel like I received your prayers and your thoughts and the good vibes and the good feelings, and I received all that. That's why I was doing so well over there. it helped me a lot. Yeah, so April 20th I received charges, and then they set aside 4 days at first for a trial in July. It was going to be just over like that, and soon they realized that wasn't enough time. It ended up being 20 court days, ended on October 26th. So in between there were lots of periods where, you know, there were breaks. So that first week, July 2nd, there were 4 court days in a row, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th. So July 2nd was 6 months minus 1 day after being arrested. And that was just 1 day short of their deadline of how long they can keep somebody imprisoned without with not without charges, but without the court starting, without facing the trial. Although, you know what, it would have been easy for them just to extend that. There were many prisoners in that prison where I was who were there for a longer period of time without going to court yet. I was astonished at the things that are going on in prison in Germany. I sometimes questioned, like, is this Guantanamo Bay, or what is this? Like, did they just arbitrarily put people in here, and then they keep them here for long periods of time, and it made no sense for some of them to be there? And I can also tell you there were a lot of people there that really shouldn't have been in jail. I met a lot of very, very good people, interesting people, and people who I thought this is absolutely not the place where they should be. Well, just like I shouldn't be there. I didn't meet any other people there for the same thing I was there for. But I would say that there were some other political prisoners of a different variety. Like, there was a whistleblower there that was definitely a political prisoner. She had been harassed and chased, basically, for years. She's from the Czech Republic. And she had exposed a big scandal. She herself was a lawyer, science lawyer, and she had exposed a scandal of university professors getting an awful lot of money, grant money, for doing the research, falsified their results, and this scandal went all the way to the top levels of government, and she exposed this, and actually got the television station in the Czech Republic to do an expose of it. They did that. Then the two producers of that television show had to flee the country for their lives. And my friend, she was being harassed. They actually physically attacked her. And then she decided to go to Germany to a friend's place and write a book. She was wanting to just write a book, and they found her there, threw her in jail. That's where I got to know her. I was so happy to get to know her. And then they extradited her. The first day of trial for us, there was the day they extradited her to back to the Czech Republic. She was in jail there. She wrote me from there and said, oh my goodness, where we were in Germany, it was like a picnic compared to the jail she was in the Czech Republic. I thought, wow, because, you know, I mean, yikes. So she is out of jail now, and I'm really happy to be in correspondence with her still. And I'm hoping that she might actually come visit. So, yeah, that's one story. And there were other people, too, who were there sort of on, you know, political prisoner type of things. One who was being accused of baby shaking, and it was vaccination damage, I'm quite sure. So she was the scapegoat for this big industry, right? So there were other political prisoners there, and these I just met the most interesting people there. And then there were others there who were, you know, you could pass by and not have that much in common with. So, on to the trial. Okay, they demonstrated to us pretty much every day that verdict comes first, and then they put on a show. Yeah, pretty much every day. In fact, I would tell the prisoners on non-court days, wow, every single day they're proving to us that we have truth on our side, and they're protecting a bunch of lies through their behavior and the things they were doing and what they were allowing us to bring forth and what they were not allowing us to bring forth. And their bias, and their very obvious bias, that it's like team prosecutor and judges, they were the team, you know. And there were multiple occasions when our lawyers did motions to recuse these judges, like they're biased, and they would have to write up a report. It wasn't just because, oh, we don't like the way you...
No. You're sitting at a counsel table.
It's kind of different from the Canadian court, so I'll just describe it. So we're here, myself, my lawyer, his lawyer, and Alfred. And on that row where you guys are sitting were the judges, and there were four judges, two professional judges, and on the outside were two lay judges. And then over there on that side of the room was the prosecutor. And then on this side of the room, the front row was the press people, and behind them the public gallery. So that was the layout. And, oh, I forgot to tell you something, and I will tell you that because I'm telling you about the layout. we just sat. We didn't sort of stand and now I'm in the witness box or the dock or whatever. It's not like that there. You just right at your, you know, you're sitting in a chair and we stayed sitting until the final talks. Of, and then I stood and my lawyer stood as well.
But there was no moment when there's actually giving of evidence or in defense or somebody cross-examined. There was?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, so what the main thing that happened that took so long was these watching these videos, all the videos, the offending videos. But the way Alfred got them to watch, that we got to watch the whole video instead of just 1 minute here and 1 minute there, the offending bits, because he felt very important we see these videos in their entirety so that the whole context is there. His whole goal is that nobody in that courtroom can say afterwards that, well, we just didn't know, or we didn't know, we didn't understand, when they are in the dock and they are the criminals and this regime is going to kip and then they are the ones, they're the criminals. They should be in the dock, right? And nobody later can say, we just didn't know, we didn't understand, because it's all laid out. And these motions for evidence, so you're talking about, you know, was there evidence? Yes. So, Alfred especially, he had these thick documents. He had some help. People were helping him prepare these things. I think, I won't say because I'm not positive who, but they were like thick documents, and even those, the court didn't want him to read them because they were too long. This was very problematic because in the German court of law, this is extremely important, you have to know this, nothing is recorded. There's not a machine that is on, there's no tape machine, there's no court recorder going type, 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 type to get every word, and then you could check the records later, get a transcript. No, the only thing that will go on the record, and even that, I was told, well, who knows, they don't keep these things very long or whatever, but are the things that you submit in writing if and you read it out and then you submit it. I mean, this is unreal.
Unreal.
So it's kind of like a secret trial in a way. Other aspects, what happened the first day. We're all sitting there, and we have these microphones in front of each person. And you're supposed to be able to push a button when it's your turn to talk so that you can be heard. Well, it wasn't on. It wasn't turned on. The system wasn't turned on. And we wanted it on, but the judge said, oh, we don't need that. No, he was kind of this guy who liked to think of himself as this, you know, the guy on the street and sort of colloquial. You could meet him in the bar and have a beer with him type of thing, and he'd be sort of like, you know, your Joe Blow. You know, he was coming across like that. He didn't come across like these high airs, but he was extremely vicious, this judge. So he said, no, we don't need that. Oh, we can talk, we can hear each other, right? And then as we're going, proceeding through the first morning there, people in the public gallery, they're kind of speaking up and they're saying, we can't hear. The judge got really mad at them. He got annoyed at them. He says, you have nothing to say. This is not for you. Anyway, or you don't talk, like, unless you're invited to talk, basically shut up. And this went on like this, and we're still struggling with this. And at some point I just stood up out of line. I didn't wait for an invitation. I just stood up out of my chair and said, either this is a public trial or it is not a public trial. If the public cannot hear and the judge does not take action to allow them to hear, and he doesn't care and he dismisses this, then they are there for decoration. This is not a public trial. This did not impact the judge at all. Like he still didn't care. And then this went on for a few minutes, and in exasperation and without even any forethought of this, it just came out of my mouth. I said, I can't hear that well anymore. It wasn't quite true. It wasn't quite true, but I just said it. And suddenly he's like perked up. He says, oh, you can't hear? And I realized, oh, yes, that's right. I cannot hear. That did it. Now, he didn't give a damn about the public. And because I had also said, when I had this little exchange with him, I said, then everything Alfred is saying about this is correct. Like, they're just for decoration. And he had said it's a Muppet show and all that. So, but, you know, it was a little too much for him if the defendant couldn't hear. That would have been a little bit overboard, right? So he gets the technician in. We didn't even do a recess. Like, normally other things we all file out and do a recess. No, he didn't even do a recess. Technician comes in, 1 minute or 2 minutes later, it was on.
Of course.
It was no problem. They've got the technology, he just was not interested in having it on. He's like putting obstacle. Now, it's not, the part about nothing being recorded, that was not his personal decision. That's just the way it is in a German court of law. Mm-hmm. Unreal. Fast forward a few trial days later, I think it might have been about day 9 or 10 or something like that, Celia Stolz, she stands up. She was in the public gallery. She was there most of the time, not all the time. She was also thrown in jail in that first week. Let me tell you, that was a dangerous place to go just for uttering some words at the end of the day. Anyway, she was there and she stood up and she complained that they have taken away our writing materials. We have no pen or paper or pencils. They took it away. When they come in, they have to, you know, it's like going through an airport security, and they have to give their ID. This is also intimidating. You know, a lot of people were even afraid to write letters or put their names and addresses on letters because they're afraid of getting on a list, and let alone coming into the court and showing yourself to be a supporter of these evil political speech criminals, you know. So then they took away their paper and pencils, and she's saying, yeah, so we can't write, we can't take notes. And the judge said, yeah, that's right, you're not allowed to. And anyway, our lawyers were very good. They jumped right on that, and actually they knew exactly which law and which statute it was illegal what these judges were doing. So I think it actually took till the next day that they made their decision about allowing them to have their writing materials. But then he specified, you're not allowed to write along, like writing every word, like a court reporter. But you can, sorry, say that again?
Transcript.
Right, you're not allowed to make a literal transcript of this, but you can take, point form. That's all you're allowed to do. So he's just dictating to them what they're allowed to do. That was just beyond the pale. I mean, bizarre. So this is how it is in the court for, I don't know if it's all the courts or if just political speech criminals, but they don't want the public to know what's going on there. Oh, another aspect of not wanting people there. Two things I want to tell you about in that regard. If anybody has any doubts of the political nature of this, the Canadian consulate in Munich was forbidden to attend. Ottawa forbade them to attend. They would have attended. They were interested, first of all, because they actually called my brother to tell them that they had just received word that they're not allowed to come. They were interested, and my take on it is that they would be there to witness that we are getting a fair hearing. That's all. They're not there to interfere with the law of the land. I know that also from when they did come see me in prison, they informed me that they cannot interfere with the laws of the land. That's not what a consulate does. However, they wish to know that I'm not being tortured or, maltreated, that kind of thing. So, but in the court, they would just witness that we're getting a fair hearing. They weren't allowed to come. Now, there was another occasion when we were watching the Off Your Knees Germany, the video about Ernst Sandl, 90-minute video, and I'll tell you why we were watching that in a moment, but just to not lose my train of thought here, there were two young people in the gallery that day that my lawyer thought that they might be young law students or that kind of thing. They were older than school kids. Sometimes schools, kids get the tour of court and whatnot, and they spend some time, but none in ours. They wouldn't take them into the political speech crime trial. It might be too subversive or something. But there were two young people there, and that's what my lawyer thought. They were maybe what do you call it?
Articling.
Thank you. Yeah, you're helping me out. That's good. And before the German translations were made of all these English videos, if there were English videos, and most of Alfred's videos are English, and this one was in English as well, the translators, they had to do their homework and do the translation in writing, and the translation would be read out loud after the video was shown. Anyway, they were allowed to be in there for when the film was shown, but before the German translation was read, they were filed out. They were filed out. And this came from I don't know if the prosecutor had a little word with the judges or if they had a little collusion there, but they were not allowed to stay for that. And I was just thinking, okay, they really just don't want people to see this because they are so afraid of people learning and hearing things that might make them think. Mm-hmm. Might make them think, like, what's going on here? Now, why we were seeing that video, that's not a video that I made or Alfred made. There are three videos like this. One was questioning the Holocaust, why we believed. The second one was the greatest problem of our time. That's Ursula Haverbeck. And the third one was this off your knees Germany exclamation mark. And that was Ernst Zundel. Well, at the end of my 6-minute short little video, I had invited the viewer, if you want to learn more about this, I encourage you to search out these titles, these videos, and watch them and learn lots more. And those were the three that I named in my video. They scroll up the screen. And so the judge had questioned me, why did you recommend those? And so I explained to him that these three videos, they each have a slightly different aspect of this story. The first one talks about the propaganda and how they convinced us, how they did it, how they all taught, you know, propagandized us about this so-called Jewish Holocaust and the gas chambers and all that. Second one was Ursula Haverbeck explaining what she had done. She had written letters for years to everybody she could think of, all levels of government and many, many Jewish organizations, asking them, where did this take place, this 6 million Jews who were supposedly gassed in this supposedly final solution. And she had written all these letters and nobody answered her, nobody answered, not a single acknowledgement even. And then she had created that video and explained that in a 20-minute YouTube video to the world. And so if there's no place where it happened, then it can't have happened. This kind of simple conclusion, right? Yeah, she's now in jail, by the way. You probably all know that. A 90-year-old woman, who just peacefully has always spoken, has not done any violent crime or fraud or theft or anything like that. No, just speaking. The third video was Off Your Knees Germany and all about the Toronto trials in the 80s and just what happened with Ernst Zundel and that, and how they tricked him then after 2001 and when he was living in Tennessee and got scooped up and back to, okay, so these three, and then I also explained that the titles were very nice, how they fit together, you know, questioning the Holocaust and the greatest problem of our time, and then Off Your Knees Germany, because that tells a story in and of itself, just those titles. I just loved how that fit together. So he's questioning me about all that, and then he says, yeah, we're going to watch those too. Oh, I just thought we just hit the gold mine and the lottery, like, that was wonderful. We're going to watch those videos in court. Like, Alfred and I were just cheering. We weren't in court cheering, but we were like, yes, this is great. This is furthering the education. Nobody can say they didn't understand it. Nobody can say they didn't know. So we did watch those. But of course, they want to use those against us, against me. You know, that was the idea. And one might wonder how they do that. And well, for example, in Off Your Knees Germany, it does explain about paragraph 130, this law. And, you know, if I was to say, or my lawyer was to say about me that, hey, okay, she lives in Canada, they don't have such a law there, although they're pretty close, let me tell you. But anyway, and she didn't really know or understand the German laws, then the judge argues, oh, yes, she did. You watched that video? You watched it in its entirety? Of course I did. I wouldn't have recommended it if I didn't. Well, then you knew. You see, so they want to use this against me. But see, it has nothing to do with whether the Holocaust happened or not. It has to do with, did you break this law that in Germany, you know, you're not allowed to question it. But did you know that the word Holocaust does not appear in that law? No. That law is so vague and nebulous and like a jelly, you know, that just
kind of... Is that the defaming the dead?
No, that's different.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, but you're not allowed to diminish the evils of the National Socialist regime. That's what, you're not allowed to diminish that. You're not allowed to praise the National Socialist regime, and you're, and in, yeah, they talk about inciting hatred. And that's kind of, that part is very similar to some of these Canadian laws, right? This inciting mm-hmm. hatred. And at the end of each one of these charges, there in the actual charges, they say this statement about you're undermining people's trust in the system, in the justice system. What a joke. They go and rob people's computer equipment, you know, do house raids, and then they take us off the streets and throw us in jail just for speaking something, and then they say we're undermining the trust in the system, in the justice system, in the resh system. Like, wow, that's quite audacious, I would say, don't you think? Like, it's really quite something. Yeah, what? Oh, emotions, okay. During the first week of the trial, I think it was day three or day two, my lawyer gave this very fantastic speech about, yeah, he made the case that this case should be dismissed because this law is absolutely unconstitutional. You can't grasp it. You don't really know what you're allowed to do or not do. It's so vague that you could actually, in this law, interpret it such that maybe the Spiegel magazine folks should go to jail because they've written articles where it just vastly changes the numbers. You know, there have been in mainstream media various reports and articles which really change the numbers. Like, you know, somewhere you have 11 million, then you have 200,000, then you have like five. It's just bizarre. But those guys don't go to jail because they're still going along with this story.
Well, even in 89, they actually changed the numbers for Auschwitz officially.
Oh, yeah. They changed the plaque from 4
even
million.
The assistance of a historian in Israel.
Uh-huh. Mm. Oh, that's right. And actually, he argued that the, what's it called in Israel, Yad Vashem, museum there, that the director should go to jail for, if you interpret this law the way they interpret for us, the director of that museum should go to jail because he actually said some things that if it was one of us saying these things, we would be charged, right? Anyway, he gave this fantastic speech with tons of really good information. And of course, he read it, but he spoke it, really. But the reason he had it in written form so that he could submit it, so that it would be in the record, right? Because like I say, nothing gets recorded. Well, fast forward to the end of the trial, in the last week of trial, when the prosecutor... Don't fast forward. After anything that our side does or says, the prosecutor has their chance to rebut or question or state their opinion on it or give us their take on it. Well, right after he gave this fantastic speech, she gets up and she says, you had too much emotion. Uh-huh. Too much emotion, and you're looking at the public gallery too often. Like, because I guess you're supposed to address the judges, and he would look there, and he would look there, and this was really great, you know? He was a human being, not a robot, you know? Anyway, that was all but I just thought that was great, because I used that in my last word at the end of the trial. That's where I want to fast forward to. And I talked about that. I said, you know, this law and the repercussions of this law, we are talking about peace and war. We are talking about, preserving our culture and our people versus a destruction of our people and our culture. The ramifications of this law is about life and death. If we can't get emotional about these things, then what can we get emotional about? And I kind of hung on that, and I was staring her right in the face, in the eyes, eye to eye, and I hung on that until she started to squirm, and she did. She just squirmed in her chair. And then I continued my talk, my last word, because she had nothing else to say. She couldn't critique any contents of what he had just presented, so that she attacked him on how he presented. So she, I guess, apparently just wants there to be robots in court, and that's it, you know, like just. Anyway, so let me just check here what things I also wanted to talk about it. Because, you know, I have actually so many stories that I could probably talk for, you know, 5 hours in a row here and tell you many, many stories. But what I think I'll do now as a little interlude is play a little piece of music and then carry on. And we'll have more stories. And also, maybe you could prompt me with some questions and this kind of thing. And I did actually write some tunes while I was there in prison. Yeah, and so I could maybe play you one of those.
For sure.
Okay, that's what I'll do. Let's see.
On Sunday, you're going to record Monica speaking in Vancouver. Okay. Yeah. Well, this is just powerful stuff. I hope you get it on record. It's very important.
Thank you. Well, it's we're living in interesting times, as the old proverb goes. Let's see. I'm gonna put this here. Funny thing, you know, you write a piece, but it's written down.
Would you like me to hold it up for you? Because it's hard to play.
No, I think I'll be fine. I might sort of get on. Oh, you know the change in climate plays havoc.
It's very cold.
It was so cold, like. In the prairies, it was really cold, so of course dry. And now it's gonna just suck up all this beautiful humidity again and breathe a sigh of relief for the instrument, because it's really hard on it to be so dry. So I had some really, really good friends in jail, and I suppose I would call this my best friend in jail, Ivana. And I dedicated this to her, so I called it Für Ivana.
Thank you.
playing that, I thought of some important things to talk about. So I kind of mentioned this earlier when we were talking in the context of Sylvia Stolz and doing her job too well. So in other words, she was a lawyer and she broke the law by presenting evidence in the court of, you know, in a speech crime trial of Ernst Sandl. So in Germany, in a speech crime trial, can you actually explain how you reached your conclusions? I mean, if there's one place where you should be able to explain how you reach your conclusions, should be in that trial, right? No. Or can you bring evidence? No, you can't, because you're making new crime. I mean, this is like, you could just sort of do this big dance, you know, okay, speech crime, I explain, new crime, new trial. I explain, new trial, new crime. I mean, this just goes round and round. It's like a bit insanity. I mean, I that's got to be the clearest indication to anybody and everybody that there's a problem with their story, right? Like, how does this make sense? Does it make anyway? Of course, I think.
It's like a Monty Python.
Yeah, it seems like a joke. I mean, if it wasn't so serious, it just seems like a joke. So that is how it is. Alfred did new crime. In fact, what's today? Today's Friday. On Monday, he's back in court. Monday the 28th, he's back in court. Why is he back in court? For things he said in this trial, our trial. As for me, okay, so I was released on time served. So I got a guilty verdict. It's not like the judge said, oh, not guilty. No. Guilty, 10 months, time served.
So what were you guilty of? You were guilty of publishing...
Hate.
Publishing the video.
Don't I look like I hate?
But what... Doug Christie was a lawyer. And Doug was driving at this idea, where did this thing take place, depending people here, especially with the internet. If you sat at a computer terminal in Victoria, B.C., mm-hmm. and the thing was stored in some rack in Montana, where does the crime take place? So what were you guilty of doing where? Where did it take place?
Yeah, that's a good point, good question. Well, actually, the judge tried very hard to get me to answer that question too of where I did I make this video,